Hello, this is Terrence McNally. In the weirdest holidays I can remember, I wish safety, health, and happiness to you and your families and loved ones, however distant they may be. Here's my 2019 conversation with sisters Constance Tuohy and Jeanette Lucy. We wrote a book together about their 30 life-changing years at a Catholic grade school in inner-city Philadelphia. Do It Better, How the Kids of St. Francis de Sales Exceeded Everyone's Expectations. Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'll be speaking today with sisters Constance Tuohy and Jeanette Lucy, two nuns who've worked together for 35 years and have written a book about it, Do It Better, How the Kids of St. Francis de Sales Exceeded Everyone's Expectations. After a three-year hiatus, I've been doing a new interview every other week since Trump's Electoral College victory. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on Why He's a Buddhist. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic.com, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. So, now to today's show. We've just suffered a five-week shutdown of much of the federal government over a made-up crisis. While we need sound, healthy, inclusive, long-term immigration policies, there's no current immigration crisis beyond the one manufactured by the Trump administration by their incompetent and sometimes cruel policies. Here are just a few facts about immigration in America. Nearly 34 million lawful immigrants live in the United States, approximately one-tenth of the total population, and reliable studies show that illegal immigration is at its lowest point in 46 years. Immigrants commit less violent crime, and poor immigrants use less public assistance than poor native-born citizens. The effects of immigrants on wages and unemployment are very small, and immigration in the long run has an overall positive impact on economic growth in the U.S. Something we've seen through the Trump administration's focus on limiting immigrants and asylum seekers are the human consequences, particularly the widespread and haphazard separation of children from their parents. Well, today we're going to talk about other immigrant children, those who found their way over the years to St. Francis de Sales School in inner city Philadelphia. Sisters Constance Tuohy and Jeanette Lucy met in 1984, both at that point with more than two decades of experience as educators. They met when they were both assigned to St. Francis de Sales and have worked together just about every day since then. For 30-plus years, Sister Constance was principal, Sister Jeanette eighth-grade teacher at St. Francis de Sales, and student after student, art contest, essay contest after contest, year after year, immigration wave after immigration wave, these children, in their care, exceeded everyone's expectations. They've written a book about their time at the school, and full disclosure, I wrote it with them. Do It Better, written with the added assistance of Judy Stavisky, who brought the three of us together, tells the stories of real-life children overcoming the challenges of poverty and immigration to succeed and find their ways to become contributing members of American society. How did the sisters do it? What did they learn in the process? And what can they help the rest of us learn to move forward from this unnecessarily chaotic and dark moment? Welcome, Sisters Constance Tuohy and Jeanette Lucy, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And let me tell listeners before you come on that we're recording this conversation Sunday, January 27th, 2019. Welcome, Sister Constance and Sister Jeanette.
Thanks, Terrence. We're happy to be here.
Okay.
We're very happy to be here. And before we begin, I just wanted to say, again, sitting here with us is our friend Judy Stavisky, who did not live these experiences, but encouraged us and led us through the publishing of our book. Often we were asked what happened to our grads, and we never had the time or method of doing that. So Judy tracked down eight of them, taped the interviews, wrote them up for the Grad Looks Back sections in each chapter. So Terry, you and Judy are co-authors of the book, and she is a lifelong friend.
Very good.
Thank you.
Very good. That was Sister Constance. Now, I always like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about on the air. And I'm not going to offer the usual brief bios, but rather let you each tell your own stories. So whichever one wants to go first, How did you grow up, and when and how did you decide to enter the convent?
Okay, I grew up in a small suburb of Philadelphia called Lansdowne. I think I was in seventh grade when I decided I wanted to be a nun, but more than anything, I wanted to be a teacher. And so right after high school, I did enter the community, and they began to educate me, and I began to teach. I spent some years in the suburbs of Philadelphia and then 6 years in California teaching there, and then 2 years in Peru, and then back to the Philadelphia area in Westchester. And then I had summer experiences in poverty programs in Philadelphia, on the streets of Philadelphia, and in the hollers of Appalachia before I ever turned up at DeSales.
Okay.
So that's a long history.
What about that decision to enter the convent? This is something which, I mean, I know people are curious about how you worked at St. Francis de Sales to help these kids, but I think a lot of people are curious how someone makes that choice.
Well, I had the IHM sisters all through grade school, and I was really impressed by their happiness, their joy, their joyful service. We used to help out in the convent after school every Friday afternoon. They were happy, loving, and joyful people, and yet they taught us well. And so I was attracted to their way of life, having spent hours working, volunteering as a grade school student in the convent after school, and seeing how they lived together and how they enjoyed being together, and how and that the fact that they were also excellent teachers.
Wonderful.
So I wanted to be part of all of that.
Sister Jeanette, what about yourself? Where'd you grow up? How'd you grow up? And how'd you make that choice?
All right. Well, I grew up about 80 miles north of Philadelphia, and I'm the second oldest of 13 children. I joined the IHN community in 1959 at age 17. And when I thought about it later, I never thought about being a teacher. I was going to be a sister. I loved the IHN sisters. And I guess that was the way it was. I was going to be a sister, not necessarily a teacher. Well, immediately I was thrown into teaching, and I started in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And then that followed with 15 years in inner city schools in Philadelphia. But the convent's kind of like the army. You get a letter to move from one place to another. In 1984, both Sister Constance and I were sent to St. Francis de Sales. I didn't know her at all, and I wondered what she would be like. I knew one thing about her. She had never been in any inner city school before, and I wondered how that was going to work out.
Very good. Can you tell just a little bit, either one of you or both of you, about either your first meeting or your first couple of days together? Because obviously what we know looking in hindsight is it worked, and you've been working together for over 30 years since. But what were the first moments like?
Well, I can tell you my first moments. In our community, when we entered, there were almost 2,000 nuns in our religious community. So I had never seen nor heard of Sister Jeanette before. And she was sent to our school to teach eighth grade, and I was sent to be the principal. And in the book, we tell about the first day, or early on, that we were having a conversation in the kitchen. And she made the remark, "I hate kids." And I didn't know her well enough to say anything, but I was very upset by that remark, because I thought eighth grade is so important in the lives of children, and I couldn't believe that it would be tragic for an eighth grade teacher to hate them. Well, I found out she didn't mean a word of what she said. It was a line she used a lot, but I learned that she certainly did not hate children and believed in them.
I can imagine walking out of there going, "Oh no, what's going to happen now?" How about you, Sister Jeanette?
Yes.
On my part, I kept waiting for this principal to arrive because we needed four teachers. And she never showed up. And they kept saying, "Well, she's in Appalachia." And I said, "Well, she better get home from Appalachia because we need all these teachers." And I knew from experience
that people don't flock to the inner city schools. So she arrived, I think, maybe, I don't know, how much ahead of time, Sister Constance?
Well, not very much ahead of time, because I had talked to the former principal before, and she told me every teacher was coming back.
Ah.
So I had no idea that I was needed early. So I thought, after I came home from Appalachia, I'll see my family, because once I get into the new place, I'll want to get totally into it.
Sure.
So I was late coming.
Uh-huh.
But I got the surprise when I got there that there were four teachers who had resigned over the summer.
Oh, my God. And so the two of you, having just met, now have to find four new teachers. Let me ask a bit. What is the parish of St. Francis de Sales like? What is it? What was it like in 84? And perhaps how it's changed or stayed the same over the years. But what was the parish you were moving into?
All right,
okay.
St. Francis de Sales had been well known. It was a large Irish Catholic parish in Philadelphia. And, in fact, the church is magnificent. It is still studied by architecture students. And they came from all over. They called it Cathedral West. It's magnificent. It was magnificent. When we arrived at St. Francis de Sales, think about the word St. Francis de Sales. Small, lowercase D-E in there. What we found out was that D-E should have been a giant red D-E, because the neighborhood was depressed, terribly depressed. There had been a mass exodus to the suburbs, and that zip code was noted as having the second highest homicide rate in the city of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
There were abandoned apartment buildings everywhere, filled with refugee families. And the large old Victorian homes were in utter need of repair. It was just depressed. And in the school, the enrollment was declining. 20 years before we arrived, there had been 1,400 students, and now there were 400.
Oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that from that, the reason that it had that large church was that this had been, in a certain era, one of the very well-off neighborhoods, correct?
It was.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay, so when you arrive, you see this the part of the town you're in, you see the school. What did the school feel like?
Well, the building was deteriorating. There was moss on the outside of the building from broken pipes inside the bathrooms. The auditorium floor was full of holes, and there were metal patches to cover up the holes. The paint was hanging in strips from the ceiling because the roof was leaking. And inside the building, you had a defeated attitude among the faculty and students. They were dragged down by the circumstances. And the last D-E is debt, D-E-B-T.
Ooh.
This had once been a very wealthy parish, and all of those parishioners moved to the suburbs, and poor families moved in. So there was no longer enough money to support the school. So we were now in what's called the dole from the archdiocese. We didn't have enough money to support the parish, and so much of the money they had when they were wealthy, they had given away to suburban schools, and so now they were getting no income. So the building was in bad shape. The school and the parish was in debt. We had no art teacher, no music teacher, no gym teacher, no computer. We didn't even have a copier in the school office.
Wow.
So it was unusual.
And then one thing we didn't establish yet is this is a kindergarten through eighth grade?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
K through eight. Two
right.
of every grade.
Right.
Yes.
That's
and
basically
when we arrived, of those 400 students, half of them were African American and the other half were refugees. They were boat children from the Vietnam War. Just a breakup right down the middle, 200 of each.
Mm-hmm.
So walking around the building, I was trying to find a way to do something about it. I was trying to get some life into it because everybody felt like defeated. The poor coming in were so poor, and the teachers felt defeated. And so I would go around and tell them, you know, DeSales is number one. Look what, you know, see what you can do and get excited. This is happening and that's happening. And so one day a child said to me, "What are you anyway? Are you the new principal or are you a cheerleader?" So I wanted to have a back to school night at the beginning of the year. And the teacher said, "Oh, we don't have them. Nobody would ever come." And so I said, "Well, I would like to try to do it and invite people." So we did have a back-to-school night, and we set up the auditorium, and we put all kinds of things out for them to see, the new books we had and everything else. And then, you know what? The auditorium was full. They came. And they had never been invited to come before, and they came. And then so we came to realize that the DE and DeSales had to be turned around into a capital ED. Education was the key, but we had to get the kids and the teachers excited about education. And one of the things that I thought would be good for them to get outside of the school itself, in the school I had been in Westchester, I was the principal there for 6 years, and when things would come in the mail about contests for essays, for art, for science, for whatever, I would put them in the grades that teachers' boxes that it was for. It was a third grade or a fifth grade or a seventh grade contest. Well, many times, depending on the teacher, they did or didn't do it. But I soon found out that Sister Jeanette would do whatever needed to be done for the kids. So I assigned her as the contest coordinator for the school. And so she began to work on anything that came in for whatever grade it was. She got the kids and got them working. So we started out and we had lots of winners. In the first contest we had, it was an art contest, and we won first, second, and third place. And the pastor even came over and said to me, "Did anybody else participate?" he wasn't a believer either. And so we said, "Oh no, there were a lot of schools." And then I would go to meetings and other principals would say, "Who's your art teacher? You keep winning all of these art prizes." And I thought, "We don't have an art teacher in Jeanette. I don't know what she knows about art." So I went and asked her, and she said, "I don't know anything about art, but if they bring something up and I look at it and I don't like it, I just say to them, take it back, do it better." And I would give it back to them. And that's what she would do with art or poetry or essays, whatever it was. She'd just say, do it better. And that's where we got the title of the book, because they would take it back and they would do it better without any better other instructions than
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, when I first...
Very, very slowly.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, when I first heard that story about her teaching art by just saying do it better and having them do it better, I was very struck, because it a lot of times I think people would assume if you respond to someone do it better, you're saying it's not good enough. But it's clear that what they heard from you, Sister Jeanette, was you can do it better. They didn't hear you're not good enough. They heard you can do even better than that. And that's
and they did.
And that message, that
and they
difference,
would.
Yeah. So it wasn't just that you believed in them, but that you pushed them as well.
Yes, I did.
Right.
I
push them. And the other thing that we did, Terry, is we celebrated everything. If we won something, I would get on the PA and say, "Guess what? The news just came in. We just won another contest. Everybody's hearing about these sales," and the whole school would start to clap. Or I'd say, "Boys and girls, we just got word we're going to get two new students from Australia. That's another country we didn't have. Isn't that great?" And they would all clap. So we kind of celebrated no matter what it was. And so very slowly they began to believe in what was happening in the school.
Yeah, let me just ask something about those contests, because as you say, at the previous school you were at, they would get the same announcements, and maybe they'd try, maybe they wouldn't. You, I think, both saw it as a way to break out, sort of, and to have things to celebrate and so on. But how do you explain your success?
Well, do it better. Jeanette can tell you that.
Well, for example, parents, one of the things we entered every contest, all right, so chemistry, Veterans Day, smile contest, cartography, you name it, we entered it. In fact, let me see, we won first place in Philadelphia in a contest celebrating the 40th anniversary of the birth of Israel. Can you imagine? It was two African-American kids who joined, and one of them won first place. So we were at the award ceremony. It was a riot.
Was it just that they had desire to a hunger to do things? You know, in other words...
When I think back to it, one of the things was many of these kids... All right, we had prayers in the convent in chapel in the morning, and then we would go right to church for a 6:30 mass. I would go over and tell those kids that I would open the school. Now, when I think of it today, I would never be able to do that. But I would take them up the three stories to this room that I used. It was my junk room where they did all their art. And they would work until I came back from mass. There was something about it. Many of them would have been dropped off at a babysitter, or they would have been home. And here I was waiting for them, giving them a project. And as they became more successful, I think it was a very good time for them. They knew that somebody was interested. I'm not saying that their parents were not interested, but the circumstances of their lives were such that when they would come to that school, I was waiting for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I had their supplies, and they could go to work. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's what happened.
Well, my guess is that part of it probably is that other schools, maybe it wasn't that important. It wasn't this special time that they had. As you had it.
That could very well have been it.
Go ahead, Constance.
Yes. Oh, I just wanted to tell you about the chemistry. We won the Philadelphia Chemistry Art Contest, and they made the poster of the winner, and they put them in all the trolleys and buses on the signs inside the buses all around. First place in the city of Philadelphia in the chemistry contest, St. Francis de Sales School, in the kid's name. We didn't even teach chemistry. We won the art contest, and it was pastored all over the city and all the trolleys and buses and everything else. Winners of the chemistry contest, St. Francis de Sales School. So those kinds of things happened, too, that made us laugh.
Another part of this, Terrence, is for the very first year, for example, I had been involved with National History Day in previous schools. And that year, the theme was tragedy and triumph. And I thought to myself, I have two students sitting in front of me in eighth grade who are direct examples of tragedy and triumph. One of them, he and his family had been in Cambodia, and Sister Constance and I had just seen the killing fields,
right?
Yes. And when we began to talk to these boys, there were three boys in the school, and they had lived through Pol Pot and those camps, and their family, their grandmother had starved to death. And as we listened to them, I thought, he should be telling this story for triumph and tragedy. So I talked to him about it, and I said, maybe you could draw some pictures. Well, he drew pictures that were just beyond anything you can imagine. He drew the temple of Angkor Wat.
Oh, my.
His father had taken him to visit Angkor Wat before they escaped from Cambodia. And his father never told him they were escaping, but he wanted his son to see their sacred place. And that project was beyond magnificent. And what we came to learn was he had never had a pen or pencil in his hand, because he had been grown up in these concentration camps and then went back home. They were reunited. They somehow got back together and were able to escape. It was so magnificent that someone, an artist, saw it and said, he's an expert in pointillism. So we talked to the boy and we said, why did you use pointillism? And he just looked at us. And he said, he didn't know anything about pointillism. And we said, why did you use those thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of dots? And he said, because I thought it would look softer.
Mm.
It was so incredible. And that, it, one of the things in the drawings that he put, painted, were all these blue plastic bags. And that explained why we had seen so many of them in the killing fields. He told us that the guards were told never to use bullets. Instead, they suffocated anyone who disobeyed rules. And so here were these blue plastic bags. He told us things like when they were hungry, they would never eat the fruit in the land because there was so much calcium in it from dead bodies that were lying around everywhere. So it just took my breath away. And to see these young kids, how much they had suffered in their lives. He went on to win first place in the city and the state and third place in the United States for that project.
Wow.
And along with him, the other boy in that eighth grade class had grown up in Bangladesh. And he wrote a research paper explaining about the birth of Bangladesh, the Pakistani Civil War. And he had details and things from his father and what his family had experienced. Both of them needed to do research for their papers because they were scholarly as well as artistic. And we would give them tokens to get on the trolley and go to the University of Pennsylvania Library to do research during the school day. Again, that could never be allowed.
Right. Right.
And Penn would never allow them in their library today.
Yeah.
But they did it. And the project, I mean, the research paper won first place in the city, the state, and the nation.
Wow.
The best research paper in the nation. So they learned, these kids wanted to learn more, and we shared it with the other kids, and it was just like a snowball. It just was growing and growing.
This is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2019 conversation with sisters Constance Tuohy and Jeanette Lucy. We wrote a book together about their 30 life-changing years at St. Francis de Sales, a Catholic grade school in inner-city Philadelphia. Let me ask, sisters, how can people find the book?
They can go to the website, thewelcomeschool.com.
Okay, the welcome, one word. The welcome school, all one word, correct?
All one word.
Thewelcomeschool.com. Okay. Let's see now. Let me have, I know that the contests bring out such rich stories. There was a family of wonderful Vietnamese refugee artists. Can you talk a little bit about them?
Yes, they had escaped from Vietnam. They had five girls and moved into a very, very poor, extremely poor neighborhood in our school. And they had quite a distance to walk. And in fact, they crossed a really dangerous highway. And the school district or the city decided that it was not safe. It was not dangerous enough that they would get free tokens to ride a bus. So they walked. Anyway, when the oldest girl was graduating from eighth grade, and their dad was a house painter, and he wasn't allowed to take off from work. And during the graduation ceremony, he was electrocuted. His ladder touched a wire. And that mother was left. She did not speak any English with all these daughters. There had been another daughter born when they first came here. Those girls were so talented, I found out by, again, getting them. And that was another thing, Terrence. When a contest would come up, I didn't just say anybody who wants to. It was an assignment for everybody.
Mm.
First of all, they learned things by working out the theme, and they also found that they could do things that they never knew they could do.
Right.
And that was an important part of all of this. But those girls won so many art contests. We were constantly taking them to to Harrisburg to meet the governor and receive their prizes. And they eventually graduated from, let's say, I have a list somewhere in the book. One got an MA in architecture from Yale, another an MFA from University of Pennsylvania, one a PhD, University of California, Berkeley.
Oh, my God.
Another PhD, University of California, Berkeley. And the wonderful, one of the wonderful things about it was they were able to pay a lot of their tuition from the prizes they won.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
Yes, yes.
Let me see. Let's shift a little bit because we focused on the let me just knit this back together a little bit. So we focused a bit on the contest because that was obviously a strategy that you hit on that was a quick, given the way they performed, was a quick route to changing the feeling of the school, to instilling pride and instilling a feeling of ownership, if you will, of the school instead of just being there. How did the work in the contest translate into the work in the classroom? How did the work in the classroom develop over those first few years?
I
was going to say the difficulty that we had dealing with the children and that came into the classroom would be the extreme violence in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember when I was a child, I would come in off the street and say, "Mama, she said this to me," or whatever. And my mother would always say, "Go fight your own battles." She would never come out and intercede. And I would never say that to these kids because there were pit bulls, baseball bats, knives, and guns.
Yep.
And so if you didn't intercede, the kids would be dead. It was very different from when I was growing up. And so we had times when we saw the violence of the children. When I was out in Westchester in the suburbs, every year we celebrated the Feast of Martin Luther King. And the children would say, you know, say, "I have a dream about this." And they would say, I have a dream that I will be a movie star someday. I have a dream that I could be a famous singer. Mm-hmm. I have a dream that I could be a doctor or nurse. And so one day I was walking past the fourth grade classroom and they had put out that they had a dream. And I copied down, I took pictures of what these kids said for "I have a dream." And these would be some of the examples that were hanging outside by 9-year-old kids. "I have a dream. I will not be any there. It will not be any more shooting. So I will not be scared to go outside or open the door and to not be scared to go to sleep at night. And that is my dream." Another 9-year-old. "I have a dream that I won't have to be scared to go to my window at night." Another one. "I have a dream that all the fighting will stop, that I don't have to hear a gunshot up the street, down the street, or on my block."
Ugh.
"I have a dream that people could go to the store without being scared of getting shot or coming home getting robbed." So this was very different from the 9-year-olds at the suburban school.
Yeah.
And so we never knew what they were dealing with. And another day, I have a quote from the book. Near the end, when we were just telling some ups and downs. And I just have to find that because I'd just like to read it to you from the book.
Sure.
Page 133. I'm trying to hold both. 133. Yes. This is just when we were telling the daily ups and downs. Tamika, a little third grader, burst through the door, ran down the hallway, and threw her arms around Sister Constance. She was sobbing uncontrollably, and it took several minutes of soothing words to find out what had happened to her. Finally, she was able to say that when she went into the corner store on the way to school to buy chips, a man came into the store and shot the owner. Sister Constance continued to hold her close and assure her that she was safe now at school. When she finally gained control, she looked up with tear-filled eyes and said, "But you don't understand. That's the second time this happened to me."
Oh, God. Yeah.
We were hearing all of these stories, and we were visiting the homes of grieving mothers when their husband was shot or their older son was shot or whatever. And it was the Christian thing to do. But after many years of doing that, we decided, you know, we have to become proactive. We have to stop this fighting. We can't just go and console people after someone's
right.
been shot. We have to do something about it.
And so now you're going to tell me about the peace room, right?
The peace room, yes. And so I had come with an experience from being on the streets of Philadelphia in the 70s, and I knew that kids don't really want to fight. I was working with smaller children, African-American children in the poor neighborhood of Philadelphia, in areas where they didn't have any playgrounds or anything, and we played on the street. I was doing games and everything with them, and there was a group of teenagers, black teenagers, standing on the corner, just standing there like a group, you know, I guess talking to one another. And I was playing with them, and finally one of these guys left the group and strutted over to me, you know, real, you know, in charge type, you know, real yeah. smooth character. And he came over to me and he said, "Where do you live?" And I pointed up a couple blocks up the street to the convent. "I live up there." And he said, "Do you fight with guns and knives where you live?" And I said, "No, we don't fight at all." And he just looked at me. And then he leaned in real close and he said to me, "I wish I didn't have to fight." And then he stood up straight again, took that swagger, tipped his hat, and strutted back to the guys at the corner. God knows what he told them he had really said.
Right.
But I never forgot that teenager's honest, honest talk to me. And I thought, we have to help children not to fight. And so then we would tell them, you know, "Let me know if there's going to be a fight or something." And they would write notes to me. "Dear Sister Constance, I don't want to fight. So-and-so wants to fight me. Don't say that I told, but pretend another way that you found out." Whatever we would do, and I would get on and say, "There will be nothing this afternoon." And I would get the two kids that I had heard about and kept them in the peace room after school until everybody was gone, and then let them go. But I wouldn't pretend who told me.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to help them in whatever way we could. And so then the next thing we did is I got a table in my office, a little round table. And if they were in trouble, they knew they could come and talk it out. And I said, "If you can settle it, you won't get suspended. You won't get in trouble. Your parents won't be told. You settle it." And so kids began to come and say, "Can we use the peace table?" And little by little, we built up the peace program. And then we had a peace wall where the teachers could nominate students for being good and for doing something that was peaceful. So we weren't punishing them for the bad stuff or giving demerits or whatever. We were honoring them if they did the good things. And so we set up what are the signs of a peacemaker, and they would be sent down. And then they got their picture taken, and at the end of the year we had a peace assembly, and we would call out the names of every one of them and have them honored. And then somebody got the peace medal also. But the other thing that happened during the year, a couple times parents came and said, "My son said he's trying so hard to be a peacemaker and nobody is noticing."
Mm.
And so he hadn't been put on the wall. "He's trying so hard." A couple times parents said that. So I had a plaque made to the unknown peacemaker. And then at the peace assembly, I explained to them after we honored the peacemakers, I told them all to close their eyes. And I said, I told them about the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier down in Arlington Cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
It was so much an honor. So the soldiers guarded it, you know, all the time. And it was that there were so many that were unknown that needed to be honored. And so if you have your eyes closed and you're thinking that you are one of the unknown peacemakers in this school, then this plaque is for you. And this is going to be put up on that peace wall along with all the other pictures. And so I would announce that each year. But the first time I did it, the plaque was up on the wall then, and one day a kid was coming down the hole, and he said, "Sister Constance, Sister Constance, come here." And I went over, and he just went over, and he pointed to the plaque, and he pointed to himself.
Yeah.
"I'm the unknown peacemaker," and as proud as can be, he walked down the hall. So I knew it had been, it had worked. It had worked. So,
you know, that peace wall, one of the biggest problems we had, especially in the beginning, was with the teachers. Because they would, suppose one day I get word that Terrence did something really wonderful today. Well, if I would ask the teacher, "Are you going to nominate Terrence?" "No, because Terrence, he's bad. But today Terrence did something really good." One time, one young lad was known as quite a character, and apparently someone urinated on him in the bathroom, and he didn't retaliate. Well, for him, that was a monstrous accomplishment. But the teacher said, "No, well, tomorrow Terrence will be bad." You know, like, but we are trying to recognize the good that Terrence did today, I would say. So not having a demerit system really was a help, because when you think about it, when you have a demerit system, you're looking for the bad things.
Of course.
Whereas it's a philosophical difference if you have this program where you're looking for the good, and eventually we were able to make that work. And it helped them have courage. It helped them have hope that every little bit of improvement they made would be better for them. And then slowly it would become a way of life. That was what we hoped.
Well, let me say that it would seem to me that when the people in authority and the culture of the school looks for the good instead of the bad, that has the potential to become a habit. That has the potential to become their culture as well. So instead of looking at either what that other kid did wrong, or even what I'm about to do wrong, or what I did wrong, if you can shift whole way of looking, that you're looking for the good, you've made an enormous shift in the way kids feel anyway, and certainly the kids in these sorts of situations.
And being in St. Francis de Sales School was a help too. Constance, tell Terrence what you always talk to the kids about him.
Okay. St. Francis de Sales, of course, had a feast day 2 days ago, and we celebrated that every year in school. But even in our handbook, when we had something about him, St. Francis de Sales, as a young kid, and as an early young man, had a terrible temper.
Mm.
And he, you know, caused lots of problems and things. But he was able to overcome it, so much so that he became known as the gentleman saint. And I said, "You can do that too." The other thing we did is, you know, so we would always say, you know, "You can always change. You can turn it around." Mm-hmm. And that was... that was a big part of it all too, and the fact that in the schoolyard, then instead of cheering on if two kids started to fight, they would break it up.
Yep.
They would break it up right away. Then they became the peacemakers. They became the ones that broke it up. Became the good ones. Until soon, we really didn't have any fights in the school.
No.
And it turned things around. It really did.
I can imagine at a certain point, people are going, "How am I ever going to get in the peace room? Nothing. There's no fights to break up anymore."
Oh, they had disagreement. We mean physical.
But they
fights.
Still disagreed.
They
but they would agreement. They would settle it if they could settle it without fighting. They could come to the peace room and talk it out. And that was the thing. And we had a little, we had the lion and the lamb, but we had a little stuffed lamb on the table. And one of the things that they needed, because we weren't there to help them, they could do it themselves, is whoever was holding the lamb could talk, which meant they had to keep quiet and listen to the other kid's side of the story. And then when they finished telling their side, they would pass the lamb over to the other kid and let him talk.
Because you can imagine the group of sixth grade girls in there.
Yeah,
really upset about something, and they all wanted to lash out. So we learned little by little the things that worked. Right. We also had a lot of Kleenexes in Pete's room.
Uh-huh.
Right. There. And did we tell them about the visitor who came? The visitor who came from one of the public schools because he had heard about our peace program and he wanted to meet the kids. So we sent, and a lot of kids came down to the peace room. And
what you said was anyone who used the peace room
this year come
so
down. Well, mm-hmm. Tons of them arrived. And so he tried to tell them about it. And then after a few minutes, after about 5 or 10 minutes, he said, I'd just like to talk to these 7th and 8th graders. Sisters, do you mind if you leave? So we sent the other kids back and he stayed in there with the 7th and 8th graders. And afterwards he came out and he said, you wouldn't believe it. I tried after you left. I said, now those nuns are gone. And don't you think this whole peace deal thing is kind of corny and all? Tell me the truth about that. And he said, they were insulted. He said, they said, sir, we are role models for the little children. And we can't show them the way to be. He said, I tried to get them. He said, if I get rid of the two of you,
yeah,
they would then be honest with me.
Yep.
And he said he couldn't believe the answers they gave him. We are the role models for the little kids.
But they also told him that it wasn't easy. It's not magic. That sometimes they had to go back into the peace room to try to work something out again.
Mm-hmm.
And they said sometimes we just had to agree not to disagree, mm-hmm, and leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm, that was sensible, too. So it wasn't this magic place where everything worked out lovely.
Right. But it was
sometimes it was hard to make peace.
Yep.
Yes, and they admitted that.
So
okay, but so this, all of this happened, and then even before Columbine, and when that occurred, other people began to take notice of our peace program.
Yes.
We already had one in place before Columbine happened. And so at one point, a whole busload came up from Washington of the school supervisors and superintendent and everything to spend the day in our school. And they wanted to know, where's your peace curriculum?
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, we don't really have one. It's a way of life within the school. There's activities. It's a way of life. And we have peace. It's the umbrella over everything. And so, anyway, that became something good for our children.
Okay.
But the violence kept intruding all the time. One time, the 4th grade teacher told us she was teaching in the afternoon, and all these gunshots happened, and the kids jumped out of their desks and got under the desk, and she said, oh, that's just cars backfiring. They said, no way. It's bullets. Well, after school, all the bullet casings were on the ground outside of school. They knew. She didn't know.
Right.
We brought people in for nonviolence training, and I will never forget, at the end of each session, I would say to the kids, type up or on the computer what you learned today. And this, I have this copy of one of the girls wrote this. This is an 8th grade girl. Today we talked about why people would or might fear death. One thing I never really thought about was naturally dying.
Mm.
I guess I hear so much about kids getting shot or beat up that it never occurred to me that somebody could actually die of having AIDS or cancer or something else. As a matter of fact, I can't even remember the last time I heard that somebody died without violence being committed.
Wow. Wow. Let me, Sister Jeanette and Sister Constance, we've got about six, seven minutes left. You talked about the older kids being role models for the younger ones. If your work with your kids at St. Francis de Sales, now at St. Matthew's, is a role model, what are the lessons? You had kids of enormous poverty and immigration in different waves. There were the Vietnamese, the Cambodians, the Africans, and so on. So both immigration and poverty, that's just was a way of life in all your years at St. Francis de Sales. What are the lessons that other people can learn and can apply at this time when people seem so worried about the poor and the immigrant.
All right, I have one right that I think of immediately. Those kids would go home from lunch, and they had to cut up top vegetables for their parents' lunch trucks
mm-hmm.
or their stores that they lived in. One boy, he kind of was an outsider. He was a slow student. His English was very poor, didn't have much of a place yet. And I found out that his family made piecemeal dresses, piecework they did.
Mm-hmm.
Each person in the family, these little kids, would do some job. And I talked to him about it, and he said that he wasn't allowed to be the button holder yet because it was too dangerous. Well, the day it happened, he told me. And I made a deal about that in class. And the next day, he brought in one of the dresses. It was gorgeous, a little red velvet baby's dress. And I think those lessons that we could learn from these kids, never wasting a single thing, working and working hard no matter what they worked. Their parents many times had been professionals in their countries, and now they were doing maintenance work and all kinds of jobs that, for which they were so over-educated. And that was a lesson to the other kids. Earlier you said about how did it translate to the classroom. It did, because kids who, let's say African-American kids or American kids who had difficulty learning maybe would have given up. But they learned from these immigrants, you keep on working, you keep working no matter what. And I think that's a powerful lesson for us in America to learn.
Mm-hmm. So
right.
Partly what you're saying is that the challenges they faced outside of the classroom actually, in some ways, made them more able.
Oh, they were. They were able. They lived mm-hmm. difficult lives.
Yeah.
The other thing we learned, that I thought all of the values we held were universal values. And we found out from listening to our children that wasn't true. That certain things like eye contact, the children wouldn't look at you, and it was considered disrespectful in some countries, and we thought they were being like shifty or something if they wouldn't look you in the eye. And then we found out from that in the Vietnamese, family is a big priority, but they have no concept of volunteerism, of helping other people that aren't family members. It's not part of their culture. And even in supporting the church, Vietnam was a missionary church for Rome, and Rome supplied all the money for the pastors, the building of the churches, and everything. So they had no concept of giving to the Sunday collection. And so those kinds of things that we thought were things that were universal values were not. Another one I remember with our Puerto Rican children, we always said for people, it's the thought that counts. So on Mother's Day, you know, you would draw a picture of your mother, or you would buy some little 10-cent or 25-cent something that you had, it because it was the thought that counts. For the Puerto Rican people, it's not. It's if you really love your mother, you'd be willing to go into debt for her.
Uh-huh.
So you might buy her a refrigerator or a sofa or something like that. And 2 weeks later, it's repossession was a big thing in the Puerto Rican community. But the mother wasn't upset when it was repossessed because her son loved her enough to be willing to go into debt for her, even though he couldn't keep up the payment.
Oh, God.
So there were different values that we hadn't learned. And so if you listen to children, you learn that. And the other thing, we listened to the phrase, but sister, so many times that came up. You would say, you know, take these clothes home, and the little boy wet his pants, and I gave him clean ones, and you just get them washed and bring them up. But sister, no, that's all right. Well, then she says, but sister, we don't have any running water at home. I can't wash these clothes. And another woman kept saying, she came up to see me, and I thought she couldn't pay her tuition. She's saying, but sister. And I said, but it's all right if you wait about tuition. You know, we can wait another couple weeks and all. But sister, and I said, what is it? She said, but I not only can't pay the tuition, we don't have any food. We're hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I didn't realize that there was an empty refrigerator in their house. So if you listen, you learn all kinds of things. The other thing I think we learned about immigrants that the ones that got to our country had grit.
Mm-hmm.
They really had the guts and the courage.
And
you
the intelligence.
See in the stories mm-hmm. and the intelligence, yes. But they got caught the first time and they were put in jail or whatever. When they got out, they tried again. They had the grit to, and that makes up the heart of America, immigrants with that kind of stick-to-itiveness to try again to get out. They wanted to be where they could be free.
They'll make it better.
Yeah. No, I mean, I so believe that as we've watched this over the last few years and as I've, you know, worked with you on this and so on, is that America is not geography, although it has great geography, and it's not, you know, wealth, although it has great wealth, that there's a spirit that made America what it is, and that spirit
yes.
came from immigrants. It's the spirit to try things. It's the spirit to try again. It's the spirit to invent something. It's the spirit that just because something new, it can still be done. All those things which we sort of take for granted as being, you know, a wonderful American virtues, many of them come because of all countries where one populated by immigrants who had the grit to come here.
And we may have forgotten some of those things. And with these new immigrants coming, we will relearn them. We will revalue them.
Absolutely.
And we wanted our kids not to be on welfare, not to be in the prison system. We would educate them to be the very best citizens of the United States that they could be. And that's why we were grateful when Judy found out what was happening to many of them, and we got the answers to success. And we're getting more now on Facebook.
Of course, yeah.
Of that.
If you each want to make, like, you know, a closing statement, what you hope people can learn these days.
Well, one thing I would say, and I said at the end of the book, we need welcome schools, not walls. Throughout our 31 years, we often had difficult days, but through it all, our anthem was always this.
No storm can shake our inmost calm, while to that rock we're clinging.
If love is Lord of heaven and earth, how can we keep from singing? And we want to thank you, Terry, who edited, challenged, and probed us with questions for more clarity and was right there with us improving the final product all along the way. God love and bless you.
Thank you.
Amen.
The website where you can find the book and buy the book is thewelcomeschool.com. Thewelcomeschool.com. And the book is Do It Better, How the Kids of St. Francis de Sales Exceeded Everyone's Expectations. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, and transcripts, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. TerrenceMcNally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. If you want to receive a weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on and usually 8 or 9 articles to kind of flesh out the conversation, you can sign up at my site or you can email me at TEMcNally, TEMCNALLY at Mac.com. You can subscribe and listen to the free forum podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes, and that's, you know, Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, just years worth of wonderful stuff there. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Mark Maxwell and Ricky Herrera in production, KPFK, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Sisters Constance Tuohy and Jeanette Lucy. Keep up the good work.
Amen.
Amen.
Thank you.
If you want to continue enjoying great shows like Randy Rhodes, Stephanie Miller, Tom Hartman, Leslie Marshall, and so many others on the free mobile Progressive Voices platform, please go to progressivevoices.com and press the donate button right now. Thank you.
Progressive Voices needs your help.
Progressive Voices has grown in terms of audience, and that has also significantly increased their bandwidth costs, and they've tried to protect the limited commercial nature of their stream. And to keep up with costs, they need your help. You could say they're sort of victims of their own success. With nearly a million regular listeners now, the cost of operating the stream has grown beyond their wildest expectations. So if you want to continue enjoying The David Pakman Show on the free mobile Progressive Voices platform, please pitch in now. Go to progressivevoices.com and press the donate button.